Well, let me see if some folks out in the audience have a question, please.
Hi, my name is Lydia Anderson. I'm kind of all over the world, a people of Broken Arrow, McAllister, Oklahoma City. My question is, how does the Native American tribes interact with the physical challenges that the state faces? Do they create impasses, or do they really elevate what's compelling right now?
Within the city limits of Norman are three Native American sovereign nations, and that's just in our city. So there are some interesting jurisdictional politics and issues that go on. I'll give you just one story. You're probably too young, but you know that there is, in fact, a casino called Riverwind Casino, just across the river from the city limits of Norman, right? When that was a proposal, and the Chickasaws came to the city of Norman with this proposal to build a casino, and they asked Norman to treat their sewage. And Norman has a major sewage interceptor running right along the river, 100 miles away from this casino that they were going to build. Politically, though, our city council members are going to stop the scourge of gambling by not taking their sewage. Very bad decision, because that would have been a perfect sewer customer for the city of Norman, paying for the things that we need to pay for anyway. That's just a microcosm of what I think we need to be thinking about with these interjurisdictional issues in politics. Don't think of them as a competition. I don't want to even get into the Southeast Oklahoma water interjurisdictional issues. Think of them as a partner, and think of the advantages that we have because we have these sovereign nations within our jurisdictions and neighboring our jurisdictions. And I see that as a strength, not as a weakness.
Yeah, if you just look, not coming from the state perspective, setting the water issue aside, which that's been a big battle for years now, but the tribes have been, of recent, a major economic engine for the state of Oklahoma, bringing in millions of dollars of revenue, bringing in millions of dollars through gambling revenue as well. But they've taken places like Durant, Ada, Tahlequah, and those communities are booming because of what the tribes are doing there in terms of job creation, in terms of building new health centers and all kinds. So they have been, they've really been a great, in my opinion, a great help to Oklahoma's overall economy. And I think having met with each one of the major leaders of every one of the major tribes in Oklahoma, they're all wonderful individuals, all that have the interest of their nation as well as the state in mind, and they want to work hand in hand with, whether it was Governor Henry or Governor Fallon, it's immaterial to them. They want to work hand in hand with the governor to improve the state together, because if the state improves, so does their tribal nation. And so I see it as a net benefit to the state.
Might just add, I think it's a great asset having the tribes and the relationship. I think we have a very healthy, very good relationship between the tribes and the legislature. And saying that, you're coming from someone who's, I'm a card-carrying Creek and Cherokee, so being from, you know, eastern part of the state. But I think, you know, they have great resources. They partner well with the state, whether it be transportation, road issues. Those casinos are generating a lot of revenue for the state and certainly for the tribes, and those tribes are reinvesting those dollars into their health care systems, providing a lot of benefits to the tribal citizens of their respective nations. So I think for the most part, we have a very good relationship, and very confident that ultimately we'll get the water issue resolved, and I think both sides are having very healthy discussions and want to see a resolution that's, again, will benefit all of Oklahomans.
Yes.
Hi, I'm Carolyn Yara. I live here in Tulsa now. I have a question most part to Senator and Representative. I personally have worked in as a constituent phone answer and whatnot for in different offices, national level, local. And I guess I'm pretty cynical about how difficult it can be, especially for a young person, to get through. And you get the impression that if you're not a big-time lobbyist or a wealthy person in Oklahoma, it's hard to really get your message heard. So I just wanted to hear, for you personally, what is the best way to contact you? And maybe speak for your colleagues as well. Thank you.
I think that's a great question. I think that's something that's very sensitive to legislators, because we want to make sure that we are accessible and that we want to respond to our constituents. So, you know, the best way to communicate certainly would be in person. Call your legislator, ask him, hey, would you like to go get a cup of coffee if you have time? If not, you know, if you're ever coming down to the Capitol, certainly drop by their office. My door's always open, unlike some others that might have their doors locked. But for the most part, most legislators are going to have their door open. They want to see you down there. It's really surprising that when key issues come up, the lack of participation from our constituents actually occurs. So when a decision, we're coming up on a very important vote, sometimes you'll get the mass media email that, you know, I'll get 100 or 200 emails, but they're all form letters. And, you know, those are really hard to respond to. You don't really pay attention to a lot of those. Anything that's an email that comes from someone in my district, we'll get a response. And phone calls, I think phone calls are you know, sometimes difficult, because you get a lot of, you got the robocalls going, and a lot of those are directed at the legislators and will come into, you know, our offices. But I would think it's very important to, again, have that dialogue, and you know, I personally welcome, you know, anyone who would like to visit. I'll always make try to make time if I'm here in Tulsa, Sepulpa, or you know, in Oklahoma City. But email certainly would be a good first step. Make it and personalize your email. Don't a lot of organizations will you know, communicate and have that form email, and you get thousands of them, and that's not very effective, in my opinion.
I'll take that's a great question, and I'll take this opportunity to editorialize a little bit, because I too share your cynicism. As someone who, when I was a young kid growing up in Del City, knew I wanted to be in this office that I'm in now. I used to put out signs for my state representative, Gary Bastien, then, and I had a dream to be here, and made it a reality, and I'm thrilled to be able to do this. But when you get to do it for 8 years and you see the way the system works, it's frustrating and a little disconcerting. I think the only way that you'll see a significant change in the way politicians handle constituents and special interests is if you remove money from the political process. However, thanks to Citizens United and others, I think we're going in the complete opposite direction. And we're going to the system now to where, on the national level, it's easier at our level. When I go to Walmart in Del City, people know who I am and I know who they are. But if you're talking about from a national perspective, forget about it. I mean, just forget about it. It's just not going to happen. A United States congressman, a United States senator, forget about it. They're not going to know their individual constituents outside of their small group of folks who helped on their campaign and a few folks they may have met at a parade or whatever. They're not going to know them. And so when you call their office, who gets a personal phone call back? Do you? Of course not. You handle constituent services. You know, if you were in the United States Congress office, odds are a sitting United States congressman is not calling back every constituent from their district. Even if they're from their district, they're just not going to do it. But CEO of a major corporation who's donated $50,000 to their campaign calls up, guess who gets a personal phone call back? That person may not live in their district, may not live in their state, but they get a personal call back. And that is all because of the adulteration of the political process done by the influence of money. And the way you change that, I think, as you go, my opinion, it's not necessarily politically popular, but I think if you went to more of a public financing campaign, similar to what they do in Arizona, but even, in my opinion, just an all-out public financing, you want to run for the state house, you get $25,000, your opponent gets $25,000, and you go to the house with it. Go. You got to go knock on doors. You want to run for the state senate, you get $50,000 apiece, go knock on doors. And at the end of the day, if that were the system, I know that the only way I got elected was because you put in a dollar on your taxes and because you went to the ballot box, not because some major CEO wrote a $50,000 check. And so when you call, odds are I'm going to listen to you. Also, it'll change our politics. Right now, when that CEO walks into the Capitol and says, we have to get this major tax credit done, you go, people go, well, they were generous. We need to be friendly. We need to work it out. They're really good to us. If all of a sudden their constituents say, you know what, I don't like that. There's more influence there than there otherwise would be. Now, that being the case, that's my editorial comment. I don't see things changing there. How do you as an individual get a hold of your elected official? I think what Senator Bingaman said is right on. If you can set up a time, for me, I encourage, I'll meet my constituents out at places, and God bless them, I'll have my two little girls with me at Walmart or whatever, and they'll want to go on and on and on, and I have to say, they're going to start screaming, or I will, one or the other. So we're going to have to move on with this. And so the way my best response to them is, what I'd like you to do is, here's my office. I give them my card. Here's my office. Call my assistant, Jackie. Set up a personal appointment. Come to my office, especially when we're not in session. I've got time. I'll come up and meet you at the Capitol, or meet you in Del City at the local restaurant or whatever. That is the best way to do it. Set up a time. And then be respectful of the legislator's time. Don't go in and say, I'm going to take 2 hours to talk about my next door neighbor's dog barking or the grass isn't cut or whatever. So don't do that. But so try to set up a meeting. And outside of that, if you're going to make a personal contact, when you call or you do an email, make sure that my office knows you live in my district. Because to Senator Bingham's point, if I get a bunch of emails and you don't live in my district, I'm not going to respond to it. I just don't have the time. But if you live in my district, I'm going to make sure you get a response back.
Let me interject a question, and I'll come back to the audience. In a minute. This is really, again, to all of the panelists, irrespective of the perspectives involved here, all the way from scholarship to municipal government to the OEA and otherwise. The point's been made that we are a low-tax state, and we're somewhere in the 43rd, 44th, 45th, ranked in terms of total taxation. That means a pretty limited revenue. The budget this year for FY15 was put together to include a good number of one-time monies, monies from agency revolving funds, from cash reserves, and don't know exactly to the tune of what, but a pretty substantial amount of cash. We're looking at next year, FY16, in terms of having to address that situation with recurring funds. The point's been made that the economy, perhaps outside of oil and gas, is perhaps somewhat sluggish. It's not quite as robust as it might be otherwise. Are we indeed, folks, headed toward a fiscal crisis in this state with very limited state income, headed toward a crisis in terms of the increasing demands of state government for funding, increasing age, healthcare costs, education costs, transportation costs? Are we headed toward that kind of a bleak future unless we do something to address the situation?
Yes.
There you go.
I say that in all seriousness, actually. Yes. Unless we change something, the answer is yes, we are heading towards that. I think I'm known, I hope so, as a pragmatic person. Notice it's August and I'm not wearing a tie, okay? So I think that I have a reputation as a pragmatic person, which means that I make both Republicans and Democrats mad quite often. But the use of the one-time funds, and I've talked about this a lot lately, the use of one-time funds in the state budget is getting out of control. It's understandable in times of extreme fiscal distress. When you're going through a deep recession, you know, you patch holes and you find funds from wherever you can, whether it's a revolving fund or unclaimed property or whatever. You just try to find Band-Aids to get you through the tough time. The problem is now that we are becoming dependent or staying dependent on one-time sources of revenue during an economic expansion that we've been having for the last 5 years. So you're increasing spending, you're reducing revenue, and that is a problem, right? At some point, you can't get Band-Aid after Band-Aid after Band-Aid after Band-Aid and expect that you're not creating a permanent problem. I think we look towards Kansas. I spoke to the Kansas treasurer the other day, and he's like, come on, give us a break. Our governor's running for re-election. I'm running for re-election, and you're using us as a bad example. It's like, well, you're a bad example, you know? And it's like, you know, and I tell people here, don't get upset with me for pointing out that you're doing something dumb. Just quit doing something dumb. And And so we got to get away from this. We got to match our recurring revenues with our recurring expenses, period. We can't keep depending on these budget fixes of one-time sources of revenue. What has happened, I think what the legislature has done, is they have proven that they cannot live within their means by using all these one-time sources of fund. And until they prove that they can live within their means, then they really do need to stop reducing them.
I was just going to add one other factor is we have the aging population you talked about, which is going to demand more services. It's also going to affect the growth of our economy. If you look at the long-run projection of the U.S. economy, we're not talking about 3% real GDP growth anymore. We're talking about something more in the low twos if you're going out 10 years. And because I actually do this, and I run this through our model of the Oklahoma economy, it also implies a slower growth for the Oklahoma economy because as the labor force ages and they retire, they're not being replaced by the same number of younger people coming into the economy. Now, assuming kind of technological progress that we typically have in capital investment that they expect, that leads to slower growth. That's going to lead to slower growth in revenues. So if we have slower economic growth, you're going to expect slower revenue growth. And I'm not sure the expenditure side is going to give us a break because aging population does impact the healthcare expenditures. And we do, as David pointed out this morning, we do have the pension problems of the unfunded liabilities. So there's a real long-term structural problem here that I don't think we've grappled with. I'm not saying we're unique as a state not having grappled with it. I read across the country it's an issue, but we have not grappled with this yet in Oklahoma. And I've been more, instead of just talking about what we think is going to happen next year or two in the economy, which is actually the hardest thing to do, because it's like predicting when the earthquake is going to happen. It's like, we know earthquake's going to happen, but we don't always know when. So economists are much better at knowing when we have structural imbalances and what's going to happen in the long run. Is it going to happen next year and the year after? That's where we're always wrong, and even though we keep guessing, because they keep asking us to guess. But in the long run, we feel pretty comfortable. We're in a slower growth environment, and this is going to be very problematic. And I've been trying to get more, that's what I've been trying to do with my forecasts, is sort of getting us thinking about the long run. Because it is going to happen nationwide, and it's going to really be a problem for us.
Go ahead. I just sort of shudder to think what this crisis in the future looks like compared to just where we are today, because in my opinion, I mean, we're there in so many places, and you know, and our corrections agency is, you know, we're at 100% capacity. We can't possibly keep enough people staffing our prisons. You know, there is violence going on. People are escaping. People are assaulting staff members. You know, our corrections employees are crying out for help, saying we can't keep enough people here because it's such an unsafe job that no one wants to come work here, and you pay us such little money that, you know, why would anyone come? And so, you know, corrections alone, I think, is truly at a crisis point right now. You know, these are, you know, anecdotal, but I think they matter. You know, my little cousin's 4 years old and going into pre-K in Purcell, Oklahoma, and you know, her parents have been told that there are way more kids that have signed up for class than they have funds to hire teachers to teach, and so it's going to be first come, first serve for our public education pre-K in that town. I'm from Lexington, Oklahoma, where, you know, earlier this year, the main bridge in town that connects us to the, you know, to Purcell, it just was not even functional. You couldn't drive cars across it for 6 months, and businesses in both of those towns suffered immensely. And that bridge wasn't even on the 8-year plan for our Department of Transportation to fix in the future. So, I mean, what?
That, you know, was great for Norman, by the way.
Yeah, everybody had to go to Norman instead of going to Purcell. But so, you know, what? I mean, I don't know. I just, it worries me. What is this crisis? Because, good grief, I don't want to get any worse than we are right now.
Senator, were you going to make a comment?
Yeah, we can move on.
Okay. One more from the audience. In the blue.
Excuse me. My name is Colby. 2 years ago, I'll raise a question. Concerning the workforce, how you're saying the aging population and then the new population, we might need, you know, a newer workforce to engage them. Don't you think that's not the problem? But don't you think the problem is actually maybe immigration?
controlling the immigrants that are moving into our country, moving into our states, that might end up taking existing jobs from their homes. How will we integrate, how will we be able to integrate them into the system safely and accordingly to the law? Would be my question.
Response on immigration. I guess the question is integration of immigrants coming into the state. Would you also entertain perhaps the attendant questions to what the economic advantage may be to the state in having an integrated immigrant population?
Well, I think that is a good question. Now, Oklahoma in the last 10, 20 years has not had the same rate of immigration that's happened nationally. There's obviously states in the nation that have much higher rates, so we're a bit below the national average. But they're going to be a key part of our labor force growth. As we say, we have an aging population and labor force, and part of the growth at the young end is with immigration. Now, of course, unfortunately, the circle always comes back that if it's going to be how well we educate them, it's going to be how well we integrate them. The better educated that we can make the immigrants, as well as those who are here, then obviously the more productive they'll be, and you know, the economy will benefit from that. So that will obviously be a challenge, is to, you know, educate them as well as others. And I know there's additional, you know, language difficulties and things of that sort that have to be overcome, but clearly it is in our interest to do that.
Other comments from panelists on that issue? Well, one more. Up front.
My name is Amina, and I'm from Oklahoma City. And I'd just like to ask Representatives Scott Inman, Brian, and Ken, do you believe that we should be raising taxes to accommodate for our spending needs?
No. I think that our revenue stream that we currently have can be sufficient. I think that it has to be, because you are not going to get a tax increase in Oklahoma. It's just not gonna happen. You've got state question 640, and I think one of the questions that we were sent the question was, should you do away with state question 640, which, you know, requires a supermajority to pass a tax increase? I kind of laughed when I was reading over the question, because it's really an irrelevant question. It's just not going to happen. There isn't an appetite in the general public to send more of their money to government. So I don't think you have to have a tax increase. I don't think you need a tax increase. What I think you need to do better is to better prioritize the spend. We underfund, I think, the core four functions of government. And we talk about the core four at the Capitol all the time, and I guess assume that people know what we're talking about, and you guys probably do. It's, what are they? Education, health, transportation, and public safety. I can tell you how we underfund every single one of those core functions. And I think that we do that because we're trying to be all things to all people, and we're not concentrating our money on those things that government must do and should do, because we are putting money in other places that we don't need to put it. It may be nice and it may be noble, it's just not a proper, necessary function of state government. So I think if we continue to better prioritize the spend and to concentrate what resources that we do have into the areas of highest return, then we can fund what we need to fund sufficiently and better than we currently are. But we have to remember too that there is something called the profit incentive, right? The profit incentive. And so that's the balancing act that government has to have. How do you raise enough taxes to sufficiently fund the core functions of government without overtaxing and hurting the profit incentive that has driven the United States economy to be the economic super engine that it is? And that's a tough thing to do. And so, but you have to keep that in mind. Government plays a critical role in supporting the private sector, and providing for safety and property rights and education and all those things that the public sector depends on. But we have to make sure that we continue to have that proper balance. And I think that we can with the revenue base that we have if we quit eroding it.
I will agree with the treasurer wholeheartedly that there is sufficient money in the state budget to take care of the core needs. And again, we have over time created so many new programs and probably have served their time that probably needed to be eliminated, and that's the problem. You talk about tax credits. We have so many tax credits that are in the system. When you try to eliminate something, trying to condense it, it's very, very difficult. There's a strong lobby, you know, legislators on any particular item, any issue, they're gonna have, oh no, this is critical, I've gotta have it. And when you talk about one-time fundings, I wish we wouldn't use access to any of those funds. But when you talk about last year being an election year, then, you know, you've got, again, who's gonna be cut? If you take $200 million out of the budget, there's going to be some loser somewhere. So by the end of session, you know, here we are again, back in the old process of making sure that people, you know, election year, whatever the excuse is, that we're not going to cut a particular agency. And that's why we fall back into the trap of using these one-time funds. And we've got to wean ourselves, you know, from those. It's a difficult thing to do, but I think that's where we're headed at this time.
I'll agree with the treasurer on one account. If your taxes are too high, you can have them so high that you stunt growth and development. But I also believe that if your taxes are too low, you can likewise stunt growth and development. I think that's what you've seen in Kansas, and I'm afraid that's where we're headed now. The big fear that I have is that, yes, at some point, in order to fund the core functions of government, taxes are going to go up on someone, and it's not going to be something that I'm going to be happy about, but it's going to go up on someone. Now, who might that be? Odds are the first group of folks are going to be businesses in the state of Oklahoma who are going to lose their tax credits and incentives, because that there's bipartisan support there. And so when somebody says, no, we're not going to raise taxes because State Question 640, well, of course, they're not going to raise income taxes on state due to State Question 640 to bring in the revenue, but they're going to go after that incentive and that incentive and that incentive. That's the first thing they're going to do. So taxes are going to go up on some businesses in Oklahoma because of it to balance a budget. Secondly, and this is my biggest fear, I think we are transferring responsibility for running the state away from 23rd and Lincoln to the cities and the counties. And so what's going to happen is taxes may not be raised at 23rd and Lincoln, but property taxes and municipal taxes are going to go up where they can go up much easier, because there's no 640 requirement for most cities and towns and counties. They're going to go up. They're going to go up there in order to pay for just common things that should have been paid for at 23rd and Lincoln, education and health care and other things like that. That's what's going to happen. And my secondary fear, knowing that taxes I think are going to be raised on property taxes, sales tax are going to go up. You hear folks at the Capitol also say, well, we need to go to a consumption tax. We need to eliminate the income tax and go to a consumption tax, which what that will do is absolutely affect the poorest of society. It's a sales tax, a statewide sales tax on a variety of things. That would affect poor folks if they decide to go that route. The other thing that I'm concerned about is if you think that elected officials today in this Republican Party are going to get elected in November of 2014 and serve 12 years without voting for another income tax cut, you're fooling yourselves. They're all going to come in. They're all going to want to go back home at some point in the next couple of years and say, I voted to cut your taxes. And so there will be continued push to cut income taxes while there's a greater burden to fund core functions of government. And the only way to do it is either to raise taxes on businesses or to raise property taxes and sales taxes on our senior citizens and families.
Well, I think we're near the you cannot ask a college president to stand for an hour and 30 minutes and expect that he has any resiliency or endurance beyond that. I will say, as a college president, that we are very cost-effective minded at USAO. We have a saying, and that is that a penny saved is a major administrative oversight. Folks, let's have a hand for our panelists.